This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 11 was recorded on May 28th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-star Danielle DiMartino Booth is breaking the rules this week. Newsletter writers are never supposed to hold themselves accountable, but that's exactly what Danielle is doing. To celebrate the one-year anniversary of her company, Quill Intelligence, Danielle has publicly posted even what normally is a subscriber-only content. You can go to quillintelligence.com to find the sample newsletter articles, or you can find them linked in the description of this podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Danielle, what's going on here? It's very unusual for newsletter writers to hold themselves accountable. Why are you doing this?
Well, I think it's important to not just walk the walk, so to speak. I think that if you say that something's going to happen and you're wrong, that you should be the first to raise your hand and say you're wrong. If there's one thing that has shaped my career more than anything else, it's sitting back years later, looking at people like Bernanke and Yellen and just saying, you know, how much further would a little bit of humility get their legacies in terms of being able to say, you know what, we got that one wrong. We did. We can't measure inflation to save our necks. So maybe we should be looking at it through a different prism, but instead they just dig their heels in. So if I'm going to be critical of that kind of behavior, then I think I should, at the very least, hold myself accountable.
Well, I applaud you for doing so. So I'm going to dive right in. I'm looking at the December 26th, 2018 Daily Feather, your daily newsletter. Your first call is Germany, you felt was the most underpriced recession risk. And you wrote here, the line has been drawn in the sand by the consensus. Germany's recession probability over the next 12 months stands at 15%, compared with 20% in the U.S. and 33% in Japan. For perspective, relatively lower recession probability breeds business cycle complacency and can also lead to overblown macro outlooks and overvalued financial assets. Okay, how has that worked out since December of last year?
Well, you know, bear in mind, this was written December the 26th, so it was actually edited Christmas Day. So the only thing that we had to look back on was kind of this Christmas Eve bloodbath in the U.S. stock market. It was terrible. That was kind of the darkest days, if you will. And yet people were saying that as bad as things had gotten to be in the United States, as much as the trade war rhetoric had heated up back then, 6 months ago, that Germany was going to walk away unscathed. And that just didn't make sense to us, being that Germany is the third largest exporting nation in the world. And the fact that its supply chain and its users in China are such massive inputs to the German economy. So lo and behold, you look forward, did we get our recession call correct? No, it doesn't look like we did, because growth came in at 0.00% in the first quarter. So we've not seen two consecutive quarters, but we have indeed seen an ISM report out of Germany that shows that the last 5 months running, that manufacturing hasn't just been weak, but it's been in a flat-out contraction. And I read a report today that said that the last leg of strength in Germany, which is their construction industry, based on, you guessed it, negative interest rates, has begun to weaken. And we know that Deutsche Bank is extremely problematic for the country, and that politics in Germany are not going the way that Merkel would prefer. So we still see that weakness as being very prevalent. And again, a market that has not properly priced it in.
Okay, let's move on to your next call. And this, again, is going back to the December 26th issue. You said you were bullish on the U.S. dollar, and you specifically said you expected it to move higher against other currencies, particularly the euro in 2019. That certainly has played out very much in your favor, as our listeners are already familiar. Where do you see it headed from here?
You know, it's really difficult to say. There's so many arguments to be made. If there's going to be a rate cut in the future, then Every single economics textbook dictates that the dollar should weaken from here. But if there's going to be a rate cut in the future and our central bank leads the rest of the world's central banks, then yields abroad will continue to weaken. We're seeing the German 10-year benchmark yield at negative 0.15 hitting its lows. So as long as there's relatively more yield to be had in the United States, there will be money that continues to pour into the dollar. And we will continue to have inexplicable, quote unquote, dollar strength.
Okay. And the next call that you made was bullish U.S. 10-year yields. And we should clarify what you mean is bullish the price of bonds, meaning the yields will go down. That certainly has played out. We were about 2.75 on the 10-year. We're down to, 2.28 as we're recording this on Tuesday. So needless to say, you've gotten that call right. But can that continue, or have we already moved too much in the lower direction on 10-year Treasury yields?
You know, it's interesting you ask. We're starting to see finally the fallout. We've seen FHFA home prices quarter over quarter increase just 1.1%. We saw in the latest Case-Shiller data that home prices are up just 2.7%. We've seen 12 months in a row of weakness. The only reason I bring up home prices in particular, and this is going to launch us into our second half outlook, Eric, but the only reason I see continued downside risk for 10-year yields is that the stickiest form of inflation is at risk. And when you see home prices increase, you're talking about very, very, very long cycles. So they go up for a long time. Once you see capitulation and you finally see home prices decline, and right now we've got the biggest divide in the history of the University of Michigan's data between how sellers perceive the selling conditions and how buyers perceive it. That tends to be broken as we're seeing with home price gains come down. Now they're at the cusp of turning negative. Once we see that happen, then there is only further downside to how the Federal Reserve, please let me not state this too strongly, mistakenly prices inflation. It doesn't matter. 33% of a household's budget is in housing. It is the biggest input by far to the core PCE that policy is made off of. If we see continued home price deflation, as we're starting to see manifest, then there's going to be downside in core PCE and therefore heightened probabilities of Fed rate cuts in 2019. That is where we see where we're headed.
Okay, Danielle, so we've seen the dollar and Treasury yields move exactly as you expected them to. The dollar's already gotten to your target. The Treasuries, you were calling for a move by the end of the year to 2%, and we're most of the way there already. Where does that leave you? What's the new call looking forward?
Well, so we see things going in several different directions. The elections overnight, over the weekend, over the long weekend in Europe, and the fact that Italy, over 34% of Italians, kept kind of this, what we would consider to be kind of a radical group in the radical ruling group. Salvini, led by Salvini, has come in and said, we're going to lower taxes. We don't care about European rules. We're going to thwart them and break them. The EU slaps back and says, $4 billion fine, headed to Italy. So you've got internal fighting in Europe, which is a gigantic economy. And if we're going to see continued downside in inflation, the next thing we would look to is how in the heck is the European Central Bank going to fight this? As John Taylor, not the John Taylor of the Taylor Rule, but a different John Taylor, an economist, said recently, you know, if the United States is low on ammunition, the ECB doesn't even have a gun. So we're very concerned going forward with Europe still mired in negative interest rates and trillions upon trillions of dollars of global debt having negative yields. We're curious to see what's going to happen in Europe to combine the forces that appear to be pulling inflation expectations in Germany down further than where they are now.
Danielle, let's come back to the 10-year yield. Needless to say, you've been spot on so far. We're all the way down into the high 2-spot 20s as we're speaking this week from about 2-spot 75 back at Christmas time. How far are we headed, and what do you think the deciding factors are that are going to determine the path of yields from here?
Well, you know, I would look to some of the areas of strength in 2018 that have now turned. Last year, we couldn't stop talking about all of the anecdotes that we were hearing. You couldn't source a trucker to save your neck at any price. And freight rates were through the roof. And now we've seen the flip side of that as the panic buying that was induced by the threat of higher tariffs. The heat's come off and we're starting to see the backlash. Freight volumes are crashing. Big truck prices are crashing. We've seen 5 consecutive months of freight volume declines. We're seeing auto manufacturing take it on the chin, inventories build. And again, I would go to slipping home prices, which are the biggest input to core PCE. If we're seeing all of these things line up, then there is only, in my opinion, one way that U.S. yields should go, unless there is some kind of out of left field, you know, Hurricane Harvey type of event that should pull the manufacturing sector in the United States, which is at a 9-year low, should pull that manufacturing sector out of what by all appearances is a recession. If we don't see that come to pass, then the first quarter earnings season that was supposed to be some kind of an aberration, a one quarter wonder, and then we were going to see profit growth resume in the second, third, and fourth quarters, it looks like that is not indeed going to be the case, that we're not going to just have our third earnings recession of the current recovery, right? We had one in 12, one in 14 and 15, and it looks like we're living through the third earnings recession. The risk we see, again, absent some kind of a massive event, because you may recall Hurricane Harvey pulled the entire auto sector out of a technical recession back in 2017. So absent or some kind of massive infrastructure spending bill that passes through Congress really quickly, as opposed to where focus appears to be, which is impeachment, and or where's the next tweet coming from. So again, absent any development of that sort that nobody's expecting, I can't foresee the inverted yield curve not portending poorly for rates.
So it seems to me that the theme of all of your calls is deflation. And this comes at a time when more and more people are talking about inflation, perhaps getting ready to make a return. Do you disagree fundamentally with the view that inflation is coming back, or is it just a timing thing where it's not time yet?
Well, you know, I understand the transmission mechanism of tariffs hurting the U.S. household. That revolves around, you know, driving the U.S. economy. 2/3 of the U.S. economy is consumption. What's going to happen if these companies are forced to raise prices and pass them along to U.S. consumers? I understand where that's coming from, but you can't squeeze blood from a rock. You can't give households spending wherewithal where it doesn't exist. You know, one of the most encouraging economic reports that we've seen is that consumer confidence has gone through the roof. Well, it's interesting because if you parse out the data, the 25-point plunge in confidence among those who are 35 years old and younger versus the 15-point spike among those who are 55 and older, this is the biggest divide that we've seen in consumer confidence data going back to 1980. That is starting to tell me that the increase we've seen in industrial layoffs, the increase we've seen in auto layoffs, the continued carnage in retail, starting to take a toll on some of your youngest earning Americans, whereas those who are 55 and older, who've got exposure to the stock market, are giddy and happy. But last I checked, you want that younger cohort to be in a good mood because they spend so much more, as opposed to 55 plus who are looking to living off fixed income and going into retirement and reining in their spending. So again, I understand how tariffs work. I've studied them throughout my career. And I understand the impetus to say consumer prices are going to go up. But if you try and push through a price increase and nobody buys your product, then you're going to have to discount it. And it too will be deflationary. There's some very good articles out there. Gary Schilling wrote one, for example, just yesterday about how counterintuitively the trade war could become deflationary. That's kind of where our mind is headed right now, especially with the strength of the dollar and the fact that Chinese companies will probably do whatever it takes throughout this trade war to maintain market share in what for many Chinese companies is the most important market they have. They might take it, they might accept a margin squeeze in lieu of losing American consumers.
Danielle, we're coming into an election year next year, and one of the things that a lot of political commentators are expecting is that some form of helicopter money, some QE for the people, free college tuition has been proposed by some of the Democrats running for president. Wouldn't these things, if they actually came to fruition, be extremely inflationary? And if so, does that mean we should be worried about them only after an election, or could the election cycle itself have an inflationary effect on inflation expectations if people come to expect these things?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask that because I've just told you that confidence among those who are 35 and younger has crashed. I will tell you that their confidence level would increase dramatically if they didn't think they had those student loans on their hands anymore and they felt that they had the freedom to go out and buy things that they wouldn't otherwise buy, like a house or a car. Not that the millennials are known as being a big car generation. But that being said, to your point, if there was this impression that the Democrats were going to sweep Congress and potentially even the White House such that passing legislation to put into effect modern monetary theory, to give the bailouts to the people as opposed to Wall Street, if there was some kind of assurance in the polls that suggested that was going to be the outcome and that the Fed would be compelled to monetize debt outright, drop that helicopter money directly into people's bank accounts, by the way, forever, because that only works if you keep doing it. You can't do helicopter money once. You got to keep the helicopters flying and in the sky. But if that looked to be the case, of course we would see upside to our inflation call. And that would call, you know, if the data change, then you better change your forecast or you're going to end up with an egg on your face.
Okay. So overall, the outlook right now is for deflation and lower treasury yields, with the caveat that we should watch carefully what happens in the political process. And if it seems that modern monetary theory or helicopter money is going to become a reality, that's the time to seriously reevaluate the outlook. Anything else that you want to add before we close today?
No, I would just say that we are at a point in the markets and at the economy where the inflection points, the evidence that the cycle is turning is amassing, and that investors, this is the time that they need to be the most nimble with their portfolios and make sure that however they choose to hedge themselves, they do so.
Well, Danielle, one good way to do that would be to subscribe to your daily publication, The Daily Feather, which normally is a $50 a month subscription. You've got a 50% off sale on the first month for new subscriptions to celebrate your anniversary. Please tell us more about it.
You know, I do, and I look at this as being a great entry point for people coming to appreciate how research is done differently. A year ago, we said that we were going to have our own hashtag, hashtag research revolution. And by golly, we keep going down this path, and we're so excited to be building a cult following.
Well, we look forward to having you back in coming weeks and getting a continuing update. Meanwhile, folks, be sure to check out quillintelligence.com, where you'll find the one-year anniversary offer on the Daily Feather. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. For Macro Voices, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.